Central banks around the world are hiking interest rates to get a handle on runaway inflation. The resulting uncertainty and talk of recession has markets rattled. Fears of a return to the 1970s dominate the headlines. After over a decade of low and stable long rates, the biggest fear is that this era is well and truly over. So, what would a new world of higher rates mean for the business and investment environment, and how likely is that to come to pass? I'm Georgie Frost, and this is the So What from BCG.
We should take seriously the risk of a permanent shift to higher inflation, higher interest rates, but we shouldn't jump to conclusions that it's already a done deal or anything like that.
Today I'm talking to Philip Carlson, Boston Consulting Group's Global Chief Economist.
You know, when you think about the last 30, 35 years, we've been on a constant downward trend in terms of inflation, and along with it, interest rates were pulled down. And that was really a secular, generational trend. A few drivers helped us get into this very favorable world of low interest rates. Coming out of the 1970s and early 80s, when inflation was very high, central bankers got a better playbook. They learned to control inflation more effectively. Paul Volcker in the United States was instrumental to this. And other central bankers after him, they continued a more hawkish approach to running monetary policy. But there were also tailwinds beyond the realm of policy, which is predominantly a story of global trade, which has been disinflationary for a long time, particularly in durable goods. And then you had automation, which took out a lot of labor costs in many parts of the economy. So there was really a confluence of forces that delivered that long-running decline in inflation, and again, along with it, low interest rates. The pandemic has upended all this in quite spectacular fashion, where obviously, as you said, inflation is very high now. The big question is whether we are in the middle of a very nasty cyclical bout of inflation, or whether this is truly the cusp of a structural inflection where we now move into a longer-term permanent problem of high inflation.
What is the risk of entering a world of long-term high interest rates, and how likely is that to be the case? What would need to happen for that to be the case?
Yeah, so I think the risks are the highest easily in a generation. So over that period that I just sketched, you know, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, there wasn't really a moment where that anchored inflation regime was nearly as threatened as today. You quite simply didn't have this enormous spike of inflation, and you didn't have as many drivers that caused it at the same time. So it's certainly fair to say that risks are the highest in a very, very long time. It is not correct, in my view, to say that it has already broken, the inflation regime. We're still, in terms of expectations, in an anchored world. You can see that both in household surveys. So when you ask consumers and households what they expect inflation to be 5 years into the future, they don't report expectations that are elevated. In fact, it's very much contained. If you look at financial markets, you can back out the pricing of insurance against future inflation and years into the future. And that price that is paid to protect against inflation is also still very contained. So it's not quite right to say today that the inflation regime is structurally broken, but the risks are there. The biggest risk really is that the drivers are not easing up and that policy fails to push back against it. So the way to move into a broken inflation regime is ultimately policy failure, not a one-off policy failure, getting the rate hike cycle started too late or not high enough, but a consistent multi-year failure of central banks to rein in the problem. That's how you got into the problem in the 1970s. People often equate it with the oil shocks of the 1970s. That's not quite right. It started in the 1960s, a very tight economy, very tight labor market. At the time, the Federal Reserve in the US had cut interest rates instead of hiking them. So there were many policy mistakes made on a long path into a structural break. And today, you certainly are on a path. Again, the risks are high, but it's too soon and too early to claim that that break has already occurred.
How would you know when it has? What are you looking out for? What are the indicators?
Yeah. You know, the big difference between the cyclical and temporary spike in inflation, and that can be quite long, temporary, and the big structural break is that inflation expectations change when it is truly broken. So inflation expectations is everyone's belief that inflation will be persistent many years into the future. And that's why interest rates have to climb. Because when you think that your investment is worth less in the future because of inflation, you demand a higher interest rate as an investor, rightly so. So when you believe that, say, 5, 7, 9, 10 years into the future, you're still looking at 7, 8, 9% of inflation, well, then, you know, you want compensation for that. And that is all captured in expectations. And again, you can, not perfectly, but you can measure expectations both on the consumer side through surveys, and you can measure them through market instruments on the financial market side. So bond investors implicit in certain instruments that are traded, you can back out what is the price paid for future insurance against future inflation. Monitoring those is quite powerful in getting a sense of inflation expectations having unmoored or whether they're still anchored. And again, I think they're still anchored, but the risks are growing that they could become unanchored.
For people who are not economists, we hear a lot about inflation expectations, market expectations, sentiment, almost feelings. That doesn't seem very mathematical. And yet these feelings, these sentiments, these expectations can often be wrong. But they can affect the material economy, which seems a bit odd.
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of the concept of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we all believe that a certain outcome will occur, that may actually make it occur. And if we're all influenced to believe certain things, perhaps because the headlines are screaming at us, you know, we're back in the 1970s, maybe that will trigger that kind of collective belief that we're on the path.
So journalists like us should stop the panic. Yeah, it's nothing like the 70s.
Yeah? You have a lot of power, let's put it that way. So it's certainly true, but that's why it's so important to monitor the expectations. If we had evidence today that people up and down the country believe that in the year 2027, inflation is in the double digits, you know, then we know that there is behavior. You know, people will push for higher wages, they will start spending differently, make different types of investments, and then, you know, we're on a path to something that is truly more destructive than what we have today, which is already quite destructive.
If it continues in this fashion, and it's not inevitable, what would that do to the business and investment environment, short and long term? What would it look like?
You know, the benefits of a anchored inflation regime are truly enormous. We kind of take them for granted because we've lived with them for so long. So, you know, a lot of people today have never personally experienced higher inflation levels. You'd have to be, you know, 60 years or older to have firsthand professional experience of such a world. But to name some of the benefits, it's fairly straightforward. Just think about the very low level of rates has a material impact on valuations of assets. So because you went from double-digit inflation in the 70s down to, you know, very, very low inflation in the last many years, that trip from double-digit to very low levels of inflation and rates allowed valuations of many asset classes to spike. You have a lower interest rate, you discount future revenue with a lower interest rate that pushes up the present value of many, many assets. You had much less volatility because of low inflation, low interest rates. Why? Central banks could let cycles run much longer. They didn't have to go stop and go because everything was, you know, just moving along quite nicely with low inflation. So you can have long expansions, less volatility in terms of cyclical growth. Obviously, for consumers and homeowners, and particularly in the U.S., where there is a lot of consumption based on credit, low interest rates have been an important backdrop to how the economy functions. And these are just some of the benefits, but they're enormously powerful. So if they were to go away, a lot of that would have to be rewritten. A lot of things would have to be learned anew by a lot of participants in the economy, in the investment space. And that's why we should take seriously the risk of a structural inflection like that, like a permanent shift to higher inflation, higher interest rates, But we shouldn't jump to conclusions that it's already a done deal or anything like that. It's a risk, a material risk, but it's not a reality today.
And you think the solution lies in the policy decisions that are going to be made?
When you think about how we got into this, it's really a succession of shocks. So, you know, it started out with too much demand in particularly Western economies, so too much stimulus, particularly in the U.S., pent-up demand because people couldn't spend freely. And that was the initial bout of inflation. And it was, not taken seriously enough with hindsight. But it's also not fair to say we didn't have additional extra shocks that came after that. So think about the supply chain bottlenecks. They weren't there in March and April of 2021. They happened throughout the year of last year. Then you had an energy surge throughout of 2021 as well that played out as we moved through the year. Then you had a labor market, both sides of the Atlantic, that was just very difficult, where labor supply was very constrained. That pushed wage demands higher. And then, you know, nobody really foresaw the shock that came out of Russia and Ukraine and what it did to commodity markets and oil, you know, many other parts of the commodity space. And there can be additional shocks. This is not something that can be forecast with certainty, because you don't freeze the current set of drivers. There will be other drivers. Hopefully, there will be in the other direction. You know, you've seen the commodity space is easing up somewhat. So we're off certain peaks that we've seen, both in terms of oil, in terms of many other commodities. Labor markets are beginning to let up in the U.S. You see some slowing in wage growth. You see the scramble for labor that came after the lockdowns were lifted. That scramble pushed out wages enormously, and they're still growing very, very rapidly, but they're no longer growing as fast as they were in, you know, September, October, November last year. So we are seeing some easing. Durable goods inflation has come down materially in the U.S., but at the same time, the fire has spread to other parts of the economy. Now inflation's in housing, it's in services. So while all these drivers hopefully are moving in the right direction, and we've seen hopefully the peak in inflation, the last prints were down, it is for policy to make sure that you now keep this on a downward trend. And it will not be enough to hike a few times and then cut again. Markets expect the Fed to cut as soon as early 2023 again, to cut rates again. I think as inflation remains quite high, even if you come down, it will remain elevated for quite a while. It is now incumbent on the Federal Reserve and other central banks to keep interest rates quite high, just to remove that risk that if you cut too soon, you are playing with that structural risk of entrenching inflation and not getting a grip on it.
Do you think by and large, though, up to this point, they've got it right?
No, obviously mistakes were made. Apportioning blame and pointing fingers is a tricky conversation, as I mentioned earlier. The succession of shocks was really a succession. They didn't all happen at once. So when central banks felt this was under control and quite temporary, not all the drivers of inflation had happened. That's simply not true. But at the same time, there was a very large demand overshoot that central banks could see and measure and monitor, and they felt that was not enough to act on. They could see the dynamics in the labor market playing out. And these are things that are, by and large, under their control, or they can influence them. Energy prices, there's little they can do. Big shocks in the commodity space, there's little they can do. They can do little about geopolitics, nothing really. So it's clear that they're in a difficult spot now, having to catch up. But to bash them for having gotten it wrong is also tricky. Basically, if they had tightened earlier, let's say in the middle of last year, and less aggressively, do you really think there would be no inflation today? We'd still have inflation today. Hopefully, it'd be a little lower. But the drivers are so exhaustive and so all-encompassing, you'd still have inflation today, even if they had hiked sooner and less aggressively.
What I want to ask is, we're talking about the risks of higher rates of longer, but high rates always bad? Is the continuation of this extremely low rate world that we've been living in always desirable?
So higher rates need not be bad per se. It all depends on the context of the economy we're talking about. So in the 1990s, you had a fairly high growth economy in the United States. You had a productivity boost that came out of, you know, really prior decades of investment in information technology. In the 1990s, it began to pay off. There was a big growth bump. productivity growth was high. And in such a context, higher long rates, 10-year yield, they're not necessarily bad. It is a problem if you have a low growth economy with low productivity growth coupled with high rates driven by inflation expectations and higher realized inflation. That's the kind of mix you don't want to be in. But if you believe that over the next, say, 15, 20 years, you can return to a place of higher, more vigorous growth driven by technological innovation, perhaps tech that finally pushes up productivity growth in the services economy, where traditionally technology has struggled to deliver productivity growth. You know, if you believe in that higher growth world with higher productivity growth, it's not detrimental to think that interest rates could move to a world of a four handle, maybe high three handle. That is not something that in and of itself is bad in the right context.
I guess that's one alternative world if we don't go into the high for longer that we're talking about. Are there any other examples of what you think could be likely scenarios from this point on?
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't rule out that you return to a world pre-COVID. I think currently, it certainly looks very credible that you move to a world of upside risks. Even after you get a grip on the current inflation problem, you'll still live in the next many years with more upside risk to inflation, as opposed to the downside risk that we had pre-COVID. I mean, it's easy to forget, but the last 20 years or so was about managing too low inflation. You know, I mean, Japan has been struggling with deflation for the longest time. Europe, or the Eurozone, rather, has been on a deflation watch regime for a long time. And even in the U.S., you sort of struggle to reach the 2% inflation that you wanted to have, which is healthy and important. I think the idea that we're moving from this downside risk to a, you know, longer stretch where risks are to the upside, even after we bring down the current spike inflation, I think that's very credible. But I wouldn't rule out either that as the dust settles, you, particularly in Europe, return to a world where, well, you know, demand is a little too sluggish, growth is too sluggish, and you have those downward pressures on price growth. I wouldn't rule that out at all. It's unknowable. You have to look at some of the drivers that can structurally move these questions. I think for the US, it's more likely that you move into a upside risk world where you have to constantly watch inflation isn't rising above the 2% as opposed to managing is not falling too low. And in Europe, it's quite plausible that you are leaving behind your deflationary fears and risks. And, you know, it would be a good thing if in a structural, longer term basis, Europe can be much closer to the 2% where it wanted to be.
As an economist, is this quite an exciting time?
Yeah, it is, certainly. It's never boring because a lot of things are happening always tactically. You know, the cycle is always moving on. There are always small and other shocks. But it doesn't happen often that structural risks are credibly presenting themselves. This is what we touched on earlier. The inflation regime being anchored and such a tailwind to everything has been around for so long that we're all just taking it as how the world works. Now, even though I don't believe that the inflation regime is broken and other foundational regimes of the economy aren't broken either at this point, certainly the risks are much, much higher than what they've been before. And in that sense, yes, it's a much more interesting time from a professional perspective. It's also a little more stressful because you know, stakes are much higher and it's much more difficult to read some of the risks that are around us now.
How much can you take from the past? I mean, we've joked about the headlines. They're not very funny, I have to be honest. They're quite doom-laden. But, if, you know, comparisons with the 1970s. Is there anything to learn from those eras? Or actually, are we being a bit too caught up in past experiences that we're missing what could be a completely brand new one?
So it's two-sided. In our work, we're big fans of using history, and we often go to great lengths to understand precisely what happened in certain circumstances. But the risk of extrapolating from the past is very clear. Basically, models are dumb. They're only as good as the empirical evidence you feed them. If a particular situation you're facing hasn't occurred before, your model can't possibly spit out an answer that is satisfactory, right? So, you know, history is a nice way of understanding how the world we're in came about and what are those structural foundations and drivers, and that's very important. But new situations present themselves, and when they do, history often has limited use. We certainly never froze the world economy the way we did in 2020. And so history didn't offer a playbook for that because we'd never done it before. If you run into another pandemic, it's going to look better in terms of leveraging history. But at that point, it didn't help you all that much. I think for inflation, I will say I don't quite like the 1970s analogy, at least the shortcut version of it, because it wasn't just oil shocks. It's just not true. The inflation regime cracked and crumbled in the late 1960s before the oil shocks occurred. The inflation expectations began to unanchor before the oil shocks occurred. It was a multi-year policy mistake and policy failure story that grew and festered over many years. That is important to keep in mind. How do you actually break a good regime? It doesn't happen overnight, but when you have spikes like the ones we have today, you certainly want to sit up and take note and manage the risk aggressively. But we are not yet in that 1970s world.
What should the headlines say then? I'm just getting my pen out here and I'm going to take some notes.
I think the headlines should focus a little more on the two-sidedness of the evidence we're seeing. I mean, even if you just think cyclically where we are, for example, in the United States, there's a lot of recession fear and a lot of coverage that basically claims we're in recession today. Why? Essentially on the evidence that we had two quarters of negative growth. You get some coverage of the fact that the labor market's very strong. The labor market, in my mind, the truth is that the labor market is a much better indicator of where the economy's health stands. With a very low unemployment rate, very vigorous hiring, it's just not quite right to say you're in recession today. And I would even go further and say, through the end of 2022, I mean, we'd have to see a radical change in labor market dynamics to land you in recession in the current year. So you have a lot of conflicting signals. They need to be presented both. It's a similar story with a lot of indicators. Think about CFO confidence that gets reported on quite a lot. When you ask CFOs around the country, what is your outlook on the economy, you get record low prints. It's abysmal mood. But if you ask CFOs what they think about their own prospects of their own firms, it's actually pretty decent confidence they have in their own performance over the next 12 months. If you ask consumers how they're feeling, consumer confidence is extremely low. But they're not putting their money where their mouth is. They're spending. They're spending aggressively. And if you look at the evidence like that, there is a, not endless, but a very long list of indicators that are quite simply contradictory. And when they're contradictory like that, there is little sense in erring on the side of doom and gloom. There's little sense in being, you know, naive and Pollyannish about, you know, how easy this is. This is a tough headwind, but it's better in my mind to acknowledge the fact cyclically now, when we think about this recession risk that we're facing, it's better to acknowledge the two-sidedness of the evidence, which is not at all clear-cut, and we're not today in a recession.
Philip, thank you so much, and thank you for listening. We'd love to know your thoughts. To get in contact, leave us a message at thesowhat@bcg.com. And if you like this podcast, why not hit subscribe and leave a rating wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.